Jack knew what Helen Page had been doing, but he knew she wasn't involved. She may have been an employee and have known Sabina personally, but Sabina would have known better than to get her involved. And if she'd known anything at all, she would have been dead a long time ago. No, she was just trying to defend her boss, perhaps trying to impress her even. But that was the most of it, he thought. Where are these companies, Don? Well, let me see. There's one in Miami, one in Austin, one in Houston, one... Are there any in L.A., Don? Jack shouted down the phone. Don was extremely pedantic at the best of times. He was known for it. But sometimes his attention to detail and his insistence on inclusiveness was too much for Jack, and this was definitely one of those times. Yeah, there's one in L.A., Jack, and one in San Francisco. What do you want to do? Jack paused and took a deep breath as he thought. He had to look at every course of action from all the angles, as he knew Sabina would have. He needed to outsmart her, to beat her at her own game. As he tried to decide what to do, his hands fidgeted nervously with a pen in his left hand, tapping it on the desk and spinning it between his index and second finger, and it was obvious that he was starting to feel the pressure, even to those who didn't know him. Don, listen to me real carefully. It's time we took the fight to her, and this may just be our way in. I want you to brief the president on everything you've told me, and tell him I'll be in contact with him directly. I need to find out the lie of the land here first. Okay, Jack, I'll do that right away. Don was almost ready to put the receiver down, but he couldn't help himself. Jack, what have you got in mind? Don't you worry about that, old friend. You just leave that to me, all right? Now tell me, what's the word from Miami and Washington?
It's not great, Jack. There are countless numbers of casualties. The numbers just keep going up. But they have pulled out a few still alive in Miami.
Well, at least that's something.
Jack hung up and turned his attention back to the SIS offices. He looked up the agent who had met him downstairs, who now sat at a desk in the center of the room, furiously tapping away at his computer. He noticed Jack coming towards him and showed him to the office at the end of the room and introduced him to the head of the L.A. branch of the CIA, Bill Tannen. Jack wasted no time and got straight to the point. He needed to get some info on a company called Medi-Cal in L.A. Bill sent one of his junior staff to look into it, but as soon as he had put the receiver back down on his desk, Jack began outlining what he wanted. He needed to know as much about the company as possible. He needed to know where it was, how long it had been there, who worked there, how many people worked there, its financial status, everything. And on top of that, he needed it right then and there. Slightly stunned, Bill took it all in and set to it. It had been a long time since he'd received instructions quite as directly as he had just done, and he was unaccustomed to it, but he set about it nonetheless. A few minutes later, the same agent who'd shown Jack into the building returned, this time brandishing a wad of files in his arms. As he placed them on the desk, his tie got caught between the pages, which pulled on it as he let them go, pulling it into a tightly wound knot of cornflower blue that stood out more and more against the agent's reddening face. Jack chuckled to himself, the first time he'd managed as much as a smile in days, and watched as the embarrassed young agent pulled it clear and hurriedly left the room. Bill Tannen was remarkably young, Jack thought, 40, if that, but he commanded his office with an authority and a noticeable sense of self-importance. He was dressed in a light gray suit and a dark blue open-neck shirt, which made Jack look even scruffier in comparison than usual, and Jack noticed the difference between the East Coast and the West. The East Coast was more European, in appearance and in attitude. Then the West, where the surf-styled attitude seemed to have intruded into all walks of life, from the commercial sector of shops and restaurants to the suited businesses of the city. Even the specter of Hollywood seemed to loom large over everything, the agents in the bustling rooms outside Tannen's door looking more like movie stars than CIA operatives. Tannen looked at the files that had been deposited on his desk. Medi-Cal seems legit, Mr. Wildey.
They're a distribution firm specializing in medical supplies in California. Nothing seems out of place.
He handed the top page to Jack, who looked over it.
Supplier to the major hospitals up and down the West Coast. Over 100 employees. I don't know what you're looking for here, Tannen continued, but they seem a reputable company. Now, I know you can't tell me what your business with them is, but down here it's a case of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. So how about you let me in on what you're doing here?
I'm afraid I can't do that, Jack offered bluntly by way of reply. He hadn't expected Bill Tannen to be so direct. He was in a position of power and knew how things worked, surely. If it was something he needed to know, he would be informed as and when he needed to be. But Jack sensed that he would have to be careful around Tannen, as he realized he may have cruelly misjudged the man. He couldn't risk anything getting out to the press, and Tannen seemed like just the attention-seeking kind of guy to do just that.
Nah, it seems to be a dead end anyway, Jack said dismissively. I don't need to remind you that the confidentiality of my being here is non-negotiable. This is just a routine line of inquiry, okay?
Of course, sir. It's just SIS don't make a habit of coming down here, and so when they do...
The SIS have not been down here, Jack snapped. Do you understand? As far as you and your team are concerned, you were just helping out with an inquiry from Washington. Nothing more needs to be said.
Tannen looked at Jack and thought about saying something, but he didn't. Keen not to rustle any feathers, he quickly realized his line of questioning was as much of a dead end as the one Jack spoke of, and he backed off.
I'm gonna need a driver and I'm gonna have to take these for now, Jack stated, holding the files. And he didn't even wait for a reply before he left the room.
He'd only gone a couple of yards when the agent who'd picked him up earlier appeared at his side, and the pair of them walked out of the building. They got into a car parked in the street outside and headed west. They joined the Santa Monica Freeway, cruising through the city, and Jack sat next to the driver looking through the files. Medi-Cal indeed looked clean, but it had only been in existence for a little over 5 years, and something about that concerned Jack. In 5 years, it had grown rapidly and become a market leader all the way up the West Coast, which was no mean achievement for a new company. Something about it didn't sound kosher to Jack, and he thought he'd check it out himself. The driver dropped him off on Olympic Boulevard, and Jack walked the couple of blocks to the Medi-Cal building. It was a small building, hemmed in on either side by much larger office complexes which dwarfed it, but from the exterior it seemed okay. A plush enough-looking building in a fine neighborhood. Jack walked up to the rotating glass door and pushed it round, the cushioned base of the door squeaking as it went. Inside, the reception area was noticeably plain, and nothing caught his eye.
"Excuse me, I'm late for a meeting with Miss Talib. Can you tell me if she's still here?" Jack asked the puzzled-looking woman on the front desk.
"I'm sorry, a meeting with whom?"
she replied. She was in her mid-20s and was the very epitome of L.A. Tall, blonde, and very attractive, wearing a designer-styled white blouse and conspicuous jewelry that drew attention to her ample cleavage. Jack repeated that he was there to meet Miss Talib, but apologized for his tardiness. He knew she wasn't there, and had no intention of taking his questions anywhere, but he just wanted to see if the name was recognized.
"I'm afraid no one of that name works here, sir. Are you sure you have the right address?"
Jack fumbled among the files in his hands as if he were looking for something.
"Yeah, I'm sure. Don't tell me she left already."
The receptionist looked even more bewildered than she had done previously. But she called upstairs to one of the floors to check. But no one by that name was present, she was informed. She repeated this to Jack, but as he stood in the foyer, his cell rang again, and he explained to the young woman he'd have to take it. Outside, the noise of the traffic was deafening, but he answered the call anyway, turning up the volume on his phone as loud as it would go and pressing it hard onto his ear. The voice came piercing over the line, cutting through the cacophony surrounding him, and it stopped him in his tracks.
"Jack, it's Roy. We've got her."
Chapter 24. Jack slammed his cell closed and rushed back across the street, hurriedly waving at the young agent to get the car started. "Wilshire Boulevard, fast!" he yelled. His heart pounded as the wheels of the car spun and the tires burned as they sped off.
"Where are we going, sir?"
"The Bank of America on Wilshire. It's number 600.
"Yes, sir."
The car tore through the midday traffic and made short work of the mileage between the Medi-Cal offices and West Hollywood, the agent swerving through the cars as Jack listened to Roy on the phone detailing what had happened. A call had been received saying that a young woman matching the description, medium build, blonde hair, had been apprehended at the Bank of America branch on the corner of Wilshire and Beverly. She'd been detained by the bank officials, who raised the alarm when the young woman had tried to rent a safety deposit box. She'd given herself up without too much protest and was now in the custody of LAPD, who were the first on the scene. Jack thought that something about it didn't add up, but Roy had him convinced, and he opened the car door and leapt out into the noise and commotion. He ran straight up to the bank, his badge in hand. The place was swarming with cops who'd sealed it off and evacuated everyone, and the young woman under arrest was handcuffed and locked in the back of a secure van in the street outside, as LAPD had been instructed to wait until Jack had arrived. He pushed his way through the cordon, waving his ID in the face of anyone who dared to question him, and walked straight up to the van. Bill Tannen was outside with the chief of the police and the FBI. Tannen saw Jack approaching, and he stepped forward to intercept, his air of authority now replaced with an arrogance that Jack could instantly tell would be a problem. As Jack half expected by this point, Tannen stepped out in front of him.
"Would you mind telling me what the fucking hell is going on here?"
Jack ignored him and walked past.
"Hey, I'm talking to you!"
He grabbed Jack by the shoulder and tried to pull him round, but Jack was too strong and he shrugged it off. He walked to the back of the van as the FBI and local police stood on and watched, and swung open the rear door. Inside was the young woman who'd been detained. She fit the description, for sure, but Jack could tell without even seeing her face that it wasn't Sabina. The woman sat in the back of the holding van, her hands cuffed together, was beside herself, and was trembling uncontrollably as two police officers watched over her. As Jack stepped inside the van, she turned around, and he could see it was not who he was looking for, and in that moment, his heart sank. Tannen jumped in the back of the van behind Jack and continued yelling, but it all washed over him in a wave of irrelevance. Now was the time for Jack to let him know who was in charge, and he turned to face Tannen.
"Shut the fuck up and get your ass out of here,"
Jack instructed in no uncertain terms.
"That's an order, got it? Get out of here."
Tannen jumped back down from the rear of the van reluctantly. He was unaccustomed to being spoken to in such a manner, and he thought his position of authority was being taken away from him by the man from Langley. But he kept complaining. It was muffled and subdued, and Jack could barely hear his protestations as he undid the handcuffs and helped the woman out of the van. She was distraught and confused and had no idea what had happened to her or why, and in an effort to console her, Jack led her to a female officer who he asked to help. He should have known it would never have been so easy. Bill Tannen was still yelling, not at Jack now, but at the agents in the bank, and he was struggling to explain what was going on.
"It's not her," Jack said to the young agent who was waiting obediently by the car. "Tell him it's not her. Let her go."
Jack watched as the agent ran off, and as soon as he was out of sight, he slipped into the car, turned the ignition on, and drove off, leaving the furor behind. He drove up to the top of the Hollywood Hills and got out to look over the city and its curtain of smog as everyone went about their business. He knew Sabina was out there somewhere, and he knew he was close, so close that he could almost taste it. Cars crawled along Sunset Boulevard and Santa Monica and West Hollywood, and as he stood watching them, he realized he was just the same as the tail-to-tail traffic. He felt the same, hemmed in on either side, incapable of changing his direction or his fate, and also unable to change the speed with which he was reaching it. And it was just then, As he stood watching the snarled freeways clogged up, spewing God knows how much pollution into the air, he knew what had to be done. He took out his cell again and called Roy. But in his head, he'd made up his mind and made his decision. And he knew just what he had to do. Inside the safe house on Ocean Park Boulevard, Sabina sat down and pulled herself together. The murder of Jackie was not part of the plan. Taking her identity was, but she had not wanted to kill her, and the effects of something outside of her pre-planned mission had caught her off guard. But she could see the ocean from the street outside, and the sight of it calmed her slightly. She took out Jackie's social security card and put it into her own wallet, taking out everything that identified her as Jane Beckett from the brown leather and putting it in the ashtray on the table. She didn't even bother to check that the house was empty and secure. She walked over to the phone, which sat on its own in the middle of a large glass-top table. She noticed that a red light on the small panel on the front was flashing, indicating that there was a message, and she immediately pressed play.
Sirocco, cover is blown. The colonel's orders are you must complete the mission at all costs. I repeat, Sirocco, your cover is blown. The colonel's orders are you must complete the mission at all costs. Erase this message and destroy.
The voice on the phone was not one she recognized, and for a moment she wondered whether she should trust it. It could be a setup. She had no way of knowing for sure. But if anyone had found the location of the house, they would have made their presence known long before now. She wouldn't have even got as far as the front door, and she knew it. But the message was not spoken by Suleiman himself, and Sabina wondered why. She'd had no contact with him directly, and had not spoken to him since their meeting in Montreux several weeks earlier. She wondered how exactly her cover had been blown, and how much the Americans knew, and what they were doing about it. As she thought about this, she realized that she shouldn't stay in the house any longer than she needed to. She got up and removed the tape from the machine and dropped it in the ashtray along with what was left of Jane Beckett and lit it, watching the orangey flames flicker and dance as the reels of tape quickly burnt and the ID melted. Sabina stood and watched the flames as the parts of her life and who she had been disappeared in front of her very eyes. As the sparks flickered and died, leaving only a small mound of ash, Sabina picked up her bag and left the room. In the garage sat a Lincoln Town Car, almost identical to the one in Washington. She heaved up the trunk and checked inside, but it was all there. The shotgun, the Semtex, the cash. She put the bomb in her briefcase and slammed the trunk down and got in the front seat with the briefcase next to her. She turned on the engine, which stuttered and stammered at first, but then roared into life, and moments later, Sabina had left. It was almost 1:45 in the afternoon when the same Lincoln pulled up on East Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. It was an inconspicuous burgundy red with white-walled tires and silver alloy wheels. Sabina stepped out, dressed in her dark suit and blonde wig, and with briefcase in hand, and slammed the car door shut. She looked around the street, which was writhing with the midday activity of one of the most famous cities in the world. The downtown area was home to the business heart of Los Angeles, and the buildings scrapped amongst each other as they stretched into the sky, their glass facades reflecting the winter sun along the streets. She walked along the length of the street, laughing to herself at the name the street had been given, Martin Luther King Jr., and wondered quite what such a name was supposed to bestow. One of the key human rights activists who was a crusader for equality in a racially divided nation. Would such a naming of a street erase the racial tensions which still divided the country, and indeed the world? As she wondered just how far the nation had come, marveling that just 5 miles to the south sat Compton, an almost entirely black neighborhood where white men would fear to tread. And a few miles in the opposite direction was Beverly Hills, the most prosperous district in the city, and one whose color was more than a little likely to be a slightly lighter shade than its southern counterpart. She rounded the corner and walked into Avalon Boulevard, a title whose irony was no less lost on Sabina, and continued north into San Pedro Street. She stopped and bought a paper and sat down on a bench further up the street. She held the paper up and surveyed the passers-by, looking for anything out of place or anything which would impede her. But she noticed nothing, and so placed the paper down on the bench. Then she got up and made her way along the road to number 120, where she entered a branch of the Union Bank. 20 minutes later, she stepped back out of the branch, an explosive primed and strapped in place in a safety deposit box inside the bank's vault, and she walked down the length of the street once more, returned to her car, climbed in, and drove straight to the Santa Monica Freeway and out of the city. Once she'd left Los Angeles, she headed north for the Pacific Coast Highway and then drove north along the beautifully scenic coast of Northern California. The brilliant blue ocean rippled along the coastline, in and out of the coves and bays. As she put more and more distance between herself and L.A., passing through Carmel and Big Sur, she could see the number of people began to diminish, and the scenery changed dramatically, contrasting with the concrete and glass jungle of the city she'd left behind. She felt as if the California landscape and the closeness of the Pacific Ocean were taking over, and she found shelter in their anonymity. Its vastness could disguise even the largest of wrongdoings, and it never judged those who walked upon its surface, just welcomed them all with equal open arms. 11 hours later, she arrived in San Francisco. Chapter 25. The prisoner took quick, gasping breaths, and small beads of sweat dripped down from under his hairline across his forehead and then down the sides of his heavily perspiring face, forming two distinct lines, one down past his ear and the other down over his nose and between his eyes. He wrestled from side to side in the chair in which he'd been firmly fastened, pulling manically at his bound wrists, but it was to no avail. He was secured, despite his frantic protestations. He'd been in the same room for almost 36 hours straight. The day had come and gone, and night had passed. But the windowless room had become a timeless bastion of endurance. People had come and gone, but he had remained, quickly becoming as permanent a feature in the room as the four walls around him. The minutes and hours had ticked by slowly in what had become an endless deadlock, punctuated only by sporadic onslaughts of questioning. But the constant threat of violence had taken its toll on the weary prisoner. He looked up and around the room, deep in the bowels of the Swiss intelligence headquarters. It was a stark and empty room, just four walls, a small table, and a couple of chairs. And the only thing which gave it any definition now was the three figures which prowled the space in front of him. Werner had spoken to the Swiss government minister and had thought his prisoner would be moved, but he'd convinced his superiors to give him more time. It was Thursday afternoon now, and still the prisoner sat in the interrogation room. Werner looked at his weary captive. "Your friend has sold you out," he said. "He's told us everything, all about Colonel Suleiman and Sirocco, and about everything you guys were doing down in the villa. You've got nowhere to go. You can sit there acting dumb, but it isn't going to make any difference. We've got you now, and one of your friends." The words poured from Werner's mouth with a ferociousness and tenacity, and he was a man transformed. The sympathetic and patient tones he'd displayed earlier were now completely absent in his singular focus to get the information that he needed. "I'll make him talk," said one of Werner's agents as he stepped forward towards the prisoner and hit him square in the face with such force it knocked him backwards onto the floor while still tied to the chair. The agent had punched him with such power, leaning in with his full body weight, that he hurt his fist, and he shook it in an attempt to relieve the pain. "No, no, none of that," ordered Werner. "Pick him up." And the two agents picked up the prisoner and chair in one and sat him up. Blood streamed from his nose and his bottom lip, and he reeled with the pain and shock, which shot through his body to the sensory receptors in his brain. The tired prisoner sat slumped in his seat. His head was tilted forward, and his hair drooped over his face. All he could hear now was the ringing of voices echoing around his eardrum. But they'd long since become too distant and monotonous for him to understand, despite the proximity of the feral mouths which made them. He arched his neck and lifted his head upwards to look directly at Werner, who had removed his suit jacket and was looking at his watch, the seconds ticking by, as if counting down the time the prisoner had left in which to reply. Werner focused on the prisoner who sat before him, and his eyes were lit up with an intent which had gone unnoticed by Suleiman's henchmen, whose eyes had barely left the floor since he'd been dragged into the room many hours earlier.
"Do you see the size of this room? How big would you say this is? It can't be more than about 10 feet across, maybe 12 feet wide. It might seem bigger sitting there in that little chair, but this is going to be it for you. For the rest of your life, locked up in a cell, 10 by 12.
Werner was growing tired of repeating the same empty threats, and inside he'd already made the decision of what to do to get the man to talk. The two agents stood in the background, one either side of the condemned terrorist, and they took the lead from their superior. Werner asked the questions. They were the pressure, the intimidating presence intended to unsettle the already frightened and confused prisoner. That was what he had instructed, and that was what they were to do. As Werner spoke, manipulating the prisoner's thoughts and limiting carefully the information he was allowed, the two agents ensured that their captive's concentration didn't lapse and made certain he was focused entirely on the questions that were put to him. Werner asked the prisoner again about the whereabouts of Sirocco, but again he received no reply. Werner sat down in the chair opposite the young Iraqi and looked around at the other agents conspiratorially, and then back to the prisoner. He looked weak now, his face pale and tired, but his appearance was misleading. His allegiance to Suleiman and to their cause was buried deep, and he was not going to give it up easily. But it wasn't just his dedication to the cause that Suleiman had brainwashed into him that kept his silence, but more the fear of Suleiman himself. Werner was all too aware of Suleiman's reputation as a vicious tyrant and a ruthless killer, but more importantly, he knew that the prisoner knew this too, and that it would be playing on his mind.